Lecture 51, Robert Frost, At Home in the Metaphor.
This is Lecture 51, and it's the second lecture of three on Robert Frost. And in this lecture, I want to focus most on the use of metaphor in Frost. Metaphor is the, I think, sort of quintessential figure or trope in all of poetry. Metaphor is the trope that allows us to move from one realm to another, to compare things from one realm to another. Even in the apparently most guileless poetry, or in fact, for that matter, conversation, we are always using metaphor. We are always shifting fields. It's the only way we can sort of make sense of things. And some people have argued that even language itself is essentially a metaphor, since words are not the same as the things that they name. All poets use it. Modern poets become very suspicious of it, are very concerned with it. Wallace Stevens is well known as a poet who really sort of ruminated about the status of metaphor, about what it means to metaphorize things, what it means to yoke things into some figurative schema and to call them by other names. And Stevens distinguished a lot between dead metaphors and live metaphors, that a dead metaphor prevents vision, whereas a fresh, vital metaphor allows us to discover something new and exciting and unthought of about something. On the other hand, time has its way, and so fresh metaphors today can be dead ones tomorrow. We don't really know. In any event, Frost, like all poets, has thought about this, and Frost, like, in fact, Stevens, has written more about this and made it a kind of speculative component of his own poems in a way that's not usually recognized, that he's concerned about the crisis in metaphor. He's concerned about the mental operation, the kind of colonizing operation that metaphor consists of. That is to say, to yoke something into another sphere is, in some sense, to master it, to gain control of it. But at what cost? I'm going to quote you a very fine sequence where this is an essay or talk that Frost gave called Education by Poetry. This is what he says about metaphor. Unless you are at home in the metaphor, and of course that in itself is a metaphor, to be at home in it. Unless you are at home in the metaphor, unless you've had your proper poetical education in the metaphor, you're not safe anywhere because you are not at ease with figurative values. You don't know the metaphor in its strength and weakness. You don't know how far you can expect to ride it, another metaphor, and when it may break down with you. You are not safe in science. You are not safe in history. Wonderful, wonderful last phrase. You expect him to say, and as a poet, I need this for my verse. He says, you're not safe in science. You're not safe in history. He's saying that these apparently objective, neutral, non-tricks-playing discourses, science and history, are just as larded with metaphor as poetry is and literature is, and he's right. People have done studies about legal discourse and how saturated it is with metaphor. People have also done studies about scientific language as being chock-full of metaphoric devices as well. It seems to be a kind of indispensable aid to thinking. We can't get clear of it. I think that that when he says the strength and the weakness, part of what he must mean by the weakness is that you stop seeing that it's a metaphor. You believe that it's the truth. You believe that it is factual, literal, whereas it's not literal, it's figurative. It's only a kind of way of thinking about something. Therefore, Frost's work is often sort of, it reminds us, it sort of gently raps on us on our knuckles. It lets us know that this is the game we play. And the poems I'm going to talk about in this lecture have a game dimension to them, even though some of them are very moving and some of them have a kind of pathos as well. Stevens went the full route. Stevens said that we remake the world, and he called it a supreme fiction. And you may remember poems like 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, which is only about metaphoric extensions of the real thing. Frost will never go that far. But he is drawn to the moves of metaphor, moves that can be thought of as dodges, moves that can also be thought of as ways of harnessing and domesticating the world. One of the poems that I'm going to read to you now is called The Need of Being Versed in Country Things. It's a complex title. The Need of Being Versed in Country Things, and I think versed is a nice term there because it evokes the notion of poetry as well as being experienced in. And I think you could probably argue that for Frost, poetry is a form of garnering experience. It's a way of learning about the world. The Need of Being Versed in Country Things. And you get the familiar Frost situation of a ruin. The house had gone to bring again to the moonlight sky a sunset glow. Now the chimney was all of the house that stood, like a pistol after the petals go. So you get this evocation of a house that only has a chimney left, it's been destroyed, and it's compared to a pistol after the petals go. And people have tried to argue that maybe there's a kind of phallic dimension to this pistol, and the petals have left it, and will it stand? And we'll see how that works. The barn opposed across the way that would have joined the house in flame, had it been the will of the wind, was left to bear forsaken the place's name. So now we know it was a fire that destroyed the house. And just by the pure chance that the wind was not blowing in a certain direction, the barn survived. Otherwise, it would be gone too. So now the barn is an intact relic that bears the name of what used to be the house. You can see that this theme is once again abandonment, ruin, the haphazardness of life, the way in which things that look like they're permanent are simply erased, removed. And he's going to evoke the past life of this house, the way that life flowed through it, in contrast to its current state. No more it opened with all one end for teams that came by the stony road to drum on the floor with scurrying hoofs and brush the mow with the summer load. That's the way the barn and the house used to function. The birds that came to it through the air at broken windows flew out and in. Their murmur more like the sigh we sigh from too much dwelling on what has been. That last stanza begins to translate things, that the birds sigh, it's more like we sigh. It becomes humanized. It becomes at least compared to a human meditation, the sigh that we would express in thinking about the evanescence of human life or the tragedy of this burned barn, burned house. They fly in through broken windows. Their murmur more like the sigh we sigh from too much dwelling on what has been. Again, very cunning language. Too much dwelling, dwelling as a verb, but also it evokes the notion of dwelling as a noun, which, of course, is what's been removed here. That's what's gone. So this poem is sort of, if you'll allow me, polysemous. It works multiple meanings out of its own terms. You're supposed to think about the kind of humming or resonance of these words. He returns to the birds. Yet for them, the lilac renewed its leaf, and the aged elm, though touched with fire, so that the natural world continues to live. It hasn't been killed by this, even though the elm has been touched by fire. And the dry pump flung up an awkward arm, and the fence post carried a strand of wire. You're hearing metaphor. The dry pump flung up an awkward arm. He wants that pump to be enlisted, but consciously, as a support here. It wants to help out with this house that's been destroyed. Flung up, and it's not easily done. It's an awkward arm. And the fence post carried... Fence posts don't carry things. That's what humans do. The fence post carried a strand of wire. For them, this is the birds, there was really nothing sad. Because after all, the trees are still growing, and you've got this sort of wonderful assistance. You've got the fence post that's doing its thing. It makes it still a living site for the birds. The dry pump is putting up its arm. For them, there was really nothing sad. But though they rejoiced in the nest they kept, because they're still living here, one had to be versed in country things not to believe the Phoebes wept. You had to be versed in country things not to believe the Phoebes wept, which is to say you had to know that these are just birds, that they are expressing no human feelings or emotions or reflections on this. Their song and their sigh has to do with their constructing of their own nest. But for all the world, that's not what you'd think. You'd look at it and you'd hear them and you'd look at that house and you'd see it burn down and you would think that there is something awful here, that the sigh has to do with human wreckage. So that it's a very, I think, moving poem about the recognition that the animal world, the mineral world, the vegetable world has no human dimensions to it, but that our world consists of always yoking them in, essentially displacing onto them, projecting onto them the human drama of our lives, which is a drama of life and death, even though nature knows no death. So the trees and the plants still live. And metaphor, it gets enlisted that way. It's one of the ways in which we bring the inanimate and the inhuman into our own human sphere. But we have to know we're doing it. We become Walt Disney when we don't. We really think that mice are called Mickey and that they, you know, live human lives, etc. This is an awareness of that operation, of what it means to do things like this. One of Frost's most famous and most playful poems in this area is called Birches. And it's a little bit long, but I think you'll like it. And it's characteristically Frostian in the way that it's going to go in two directions at once. It's going to play out a might-have-been or a might-be interpretation, and then it's going to reject it. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay, as ice storms do. So figure what you've got here. Birches that are bent like this against the other straight trees. I like to think that boys have been swinging them. But we know that it's ice storms that make this happen. And he's going to talk about ice storms here. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. It's a beautiful description of what trees look like coated by ice, and then as it melts and cracks. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust, such heaps of broken glass to sweep away. You'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen, and you would think, my having read this, that this poem is going to be about ice storms, but it's not. They're dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once they are bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground, and this really surprising description of what the trunks look like as they're like this and trailing their leaves on the ground. You've got to visualize this. Like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. Very playful description of what the trees look like, bent like that. And then this wonderful line. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them. So we're back to the beginning of the poem. I like to think some boy's been swinging them. That's really what he wants to talk about. Here's the scientific explanation. I'll give it to you. I'll play it out. But now let's get down to the heart of the matter. I should prefer to think we're in the realm of metaphor, human projection, human desire, human fantasy. I should prefer to have some boy bend them. And now you're going to get the evocation of this boy. As he went out and in to fetch the cows, some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. Now, I don't want to get lewd here, but people have argued, and I think suggestively, that there are kind of sexual energies in this poem. Think about that reference again to the tree that's bent down with the leaves on the ground. It looks like some girl bending over with her hair over her head like that. It's a posture that you might want to think about for somebody to be bent like that. Because you'll see how these images get picked up again as the poem continues. And then a boy playing alone, let's think about some of the games that boys play when they might be alone, because the poem may be about that too. One by one, he subdued his father's trees. Just think about some of the possibilities here. By riding them down over and over again, they're the trees, he rides them down. Until he took the stiffness out of them, and there you can again, it's a possible sexual reference. And not one but hung limp. Really does go that direction. Not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. When you let go, when you get to the edge of things, when you get to the limit, all of my terms can work in several different directions here. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. Wonderful sort of suggestive play of the boy who rides the birch. He's all the way out as the birch begins to bend under him and then sort of swishes down to the ground. Moment of release. So was I once myself a swinger of birches. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from Earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish, and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good both going and coming back. I mean, there's a wonderful economy here. You don't lose on any one of these particular trajectories. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. It's a beautiful poem. It's written, again, in the laconic, matter-of-fact, you know, plain style of Frost. There's no $50 words in this poem at all. And it takes something that none of us has ever thought about what it means to sort of ride these trees, going up towards heaven, but still coming down. It represents really the kind of rhythmic, pulsing life that as Frost sees it. I'm going to quote you another passage from Frost in one of his essays, because I think it carries some of the same feeling here about the rhythmic dimensions of things. The most exciting movement in nature, he's writing about the poetry of Amy Lowell here, is not progress, advance, but expansion and contraction, the opening and shutting of the eye, the hand, the heart, the mind. We throw our arms wide with a gesture of religion to the universe. We close them around a person. That the instinct is to possess the world. We close them around a person. Frost has a very weird optic on things. He's coming at the world from an angle that it reminds me of Dickinson that way, that there's something surprising about the vantage point of Frost. Is this whole poem about birches, it seems to me, suggests that he makes this poem speak to us of sexual education, of maturation, of pleasure, of release, but also of pure play, of moving up and coming down, of a life being played out between aspirations towards the heavens, etc., and life on the earth. Now, the next poem that I'm going to very briefly talk about is one of Frost's most famous poems. I don't think it's one of his best. It's called Directive. It's a very late poem. It's a very playful poem also. And it's a poem, as the title suggests, Directive, about going to heaven, about being saved. And I think it's clearly Frost trying to write the kind of poem that T.S. Eliot wrote in The Wasteland, a poem about salvation, a poem about finding your way to the source, a way back to wholeness, a way to healing. It's a poem that is filled with lots of sort of checks and balances. It starts with a recognition of how confused our state is. Back out of all this now, too much for us. Back in a time made simple by the loss of detail, burned, dissolved, and broken off like a graveyard marble sculpture in the weather. So getting clear of all of that, back behind all of those things, there is a house that is no more a house upon a farm that is no more a farm and in a town that is no more a town. The road there if you'll let a guide direct you, who only has at heart you're getting lost, etc. And that's what the poem is about, to this sort of never-never land, this origin of wholeness, purity, truth, that would somehow be behind or beyond all of the messy complications of the lives that we lead. In the end of the poem, he talks about how you get to this place, this source. And if you're lost enough to find yourself by now, pull in your ladder road behind you and put up a sign closed to all but me. Then make yourself at home. The only field now left's no bigger than a harness gall. First, there's the children's house of make-believe, some shattered dishes beneath a pine, the playthings in the house of playhouse of children. Weep for what little things could make them glad, so that the place you're going to is being sort of characterized as a dollhouse, a playhouse, a construct. Then for the house that is no more a house, but only a belilacked cellar hole, now slowly closing like a dent in dough. That notation to me is mind-boggling. What you're going to first is compared to a playhouse, then it's a house that's no more a house, and then it's a belilacked, I've never heard that adjective before, a belilacked cellar hole. You're going into the pit, and then it is disappearing as you watch, because it's like closing like a dent in dough. You put your hand in dough, and you watch the dough just get rid of the space that you've just made. All of this is the elusiveness of your salvation, of finding the source, of getting back to God. And it closes with the difficulty of ever getting there. I have kept hidden in the instep arch of an old cedar at the waterside a broken drinking goblet like the Grail. That's a clear reference to Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, the story about the Grail and the Fisher King and all of that. A broken drinking goblet like the Grail under a spell so the wrong ones can't find it, so can't get saved, as St. Mark says they mustn't. I stole the goblet from the children's playhouse. Here are your waters and your watering place. Drink and be whole again beyond confusion. Well, as I said, I don't think this is one of Frost's greatest performances. It is one that is frequently cited. It is certainly the nostalgia for wholeness, for finding the source. It's his sort of, I think, mocking references to the erudite poetry of Eliot. It transforms it into childlike ventures. And it's very open to question whether any salvation is going to be possible here. The more, I think, provocative pieces in Frost about finding some vision of God or wholeness or truth are really located in the poems that stay with the natural world, that don't truck in grails and sources of this sort. And I'm going to look at a poem called The Most of It, which is one of his greater performances, I think. He thought he kept the universe alone, is the first line. It's a line that Wallace Stevens could have written. He thought he kept the universe alone, the hubris of that. For all the voice and answer he could wake was but the mocking echo of his own from some tree-hidden cliff across the lake. Echo, as you probably know, is one of the oldest motifs in poetry. It goes back to Ovid. You see it in Milton. You have it in Wordsworth, that it's the sort of narcissist view of the world, that all we can hear is a projection of our own voice, that the world, that we live alone, surrounded by our own echoes, that there can be no contact with others, no apprehension of others. So all this person, he's seeking for an answer, all he hears is his own echo. Some morning from the boulder-broken beach, he would cry out for life, that what it wants is not its own love back in copy speech, echo, but counter-love, original response. And nothing ever came of what he cried. There's the lost individual crying for response, for the universe to respond, for there to be some final encounter. Nothing ever came of what he cried, and here comes the great conclusion, unless it was the embodiment that crashed in the cliff's talus on the other side, and then in the far distant water splashed, but after a time allowed for it to swim, instead of proving human, when it neared, and someone else additional to him, as a great buck it powerfully appeared, pushing the crumpled water, just listen to this language. This is a scene of great power, but it's not a human figure that we can cotton up to, some father god that can accept us, pushing the crumpled water up ahead and landed pouring like a waterfall and stumbled through the rocks with horny tread and forced the underbrush. And that was all. It's one of Frost's remarkable poems because it gives us this apprehension of some extraordinary force, this animal god, I suppose, this great buck that essentially sort of forces the elements into his own path. The crumpled water, it becomes the waterfall, horny tread, and that was all. And it's as if Frost is saying the natural world is the world of great power. The natural world has a kind of fabulousness, because this is a story about fable, fabulousness that we can never domesticate. Our little anthropological schemes, a god who has a mustache or has a beard and has white hair and who loves us and takes us to his bosom, what a cheap trick that is, that the world has a kind of raw imperial power that we can see all the time in waterfalls and in the animals in the woods. If we want to try to imagine Godhead and divinity, why don't we think along those terms? So I think that this poem, for me, has a kind of authority and a kind of integrity that the piece about the Grail doesn't quite have. The last piece that I'm going to read you is a follow-up to this poem, and it has a wonderful title, Never Again Would Bird Song Be the Same. And we've had that motif in a lot of the poems that I've read you about the song of the bird, the song of the thrush, the dying light of the sun becoming the bird song. Now we're going to see how it works here, and it's going to be a rather strange piece for Frost. He would declare, and could himself believe, so you've got it, like you did in the last one, this sort of male speaker who's being treated a bit ironically, who doesn't have the full picture. He would declare, and could himself believe, that the birds there in all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound, her tone of meaning, but without the words. This is unusual for Frost because he's referred us all the way back to Adam and Eve and the garden. That's the garden. It's Eden that's being talked about. And Eve's own voice has somehow conferred onto the bird song its music, had added to their own an oversound, her tone of meaning, but without the words. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. So it's not just Eve saying, close the door, Adam, or anything like that. It's laughter, it's call. I think joy is invoked. Perhaps sexual connection is invoked, love between them. That produces the sound that moves up, aloft. That's the sound that becomes part of the bird's own song. Be that as it may, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices crossed had now persisted in the woods so long. Now, mind you, you're not in the garden anymore. You're not back in Eden. You're in the woods today. The huge sort of leap here had now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Never again would birdsong be the same. And to do that to birds was why she came. It's just a haunting piece that the bird song comes from Eve's having come and communicated to the heavens her laughter and her joy, her call. Not the words, the sound. And now it's in the voices of the birds, and now we hear it. So that now, through this, we move all the way back to the story of Adam and Eve. We hear the human voice. I'm still talking about metaphor, how we domesticate the world, how a world of inanimate things or of animals somehow gets yoked into a human story, a human fable. That's what this whole piece is about. We now hear Eve's voice, make out Eve's voice in the song of the birds. We have to work to do that, perhaps. That is the labor that makes the world a fluid place. It's the labor the metaphor that allows us to hear a song, the chirping of the birds, and to imagine this lovely fable of this being originally the joy and call of Eve. I'd like to suggest to you in closing that is a lovely image, perhaps, of the continuity of poetry itself. That poetry is not simply what I write today. It is birdsong. It is echo. It is a voice that's made up of other voices. It's Frost, I think, signaling the historicity, the melodious tradition of his own medium. There's a sense here in which literature is being thought about itself, that the song we hear is a song that has been going on forever. It's echo, once again, as it was in the other piece. And that there is a kind of labor, a critical labor, a reading labor, an imaginative labor involved in that. But there's also a very great sense of vision and recall and recapture when we do that. Thank you.